Afternoon, brethren. I'd like to thank Wesley for that special music. He always has a very serene manner of in his composition and his performance, which I really appreciate, really enjoy that. Privilege and a pleasure to be here with you this afternoon. I'd like to welcome those that are guests that are here with us and also those that may be visiting us via the cybercast. You know, as has already been pointed out a couple of times, you know, the fall feasts are upon us. You know, Feast of Trumpets is just 17 days from today. Feast of Tabernacles will be or is 1 month from today to the day. You know, some of us will be traveling and we'll very shortly we'll be, you know, going to the place where God has placed his name for us to keep the feast, whether that be near or whether that be far. By way of introduction, I'd like to to mention that the company that I work for in the technology area, occasionally, you know, depending on budgets, we'll send several of us to a technical conference somewhere in the United States for us to have the opportunity to further our technical education or to broaden our understanding about technical matters. And one of the things that we do when there are more than one individual that has the opportunity to go, is that we will plan out by looking at the sessions that are offered, and we will map out a plan whereby we get the maximum amount of coverage of the material that is presented. And typically some of the technical conferences are 5-day conferences, and they're 4 1.5-hour sessions each day, except for the last day. Now, there are other activities before the beginning. There may be a keynote speaker, you know, for breakfast or something like that, but there are 4 1-hour, 1.5-hour activities, educational sessions each day. What we try to do is to map out where that if there's an area where that several of us have the same interests, we'll spread out the attendance so that we can cover as many sections as possible, and then we can compile our notes or the educational materials that are provided. Thereby, we can come back to the rest of the team, and we can present the information that we learn. Because of the cost, it's a significant contribution on behalf of the company to fund, the tuition, which can range on some of the technical conferences from, $1,500 to $3,000 or so, depending on the size and the nature of the conference. And then you've got the expense with the travel and with the lodging. So it's something that is not done lightly. I can't help but wonder sometimes if I take the same approach in preparation for the feast. You know, if I think about how I am going to attend the feast where God has placed his name and how I'm going to maximize my festival experience, how will I maximize the learning opportunities that I will have at the feast that God, has for us? How will I avail myself of, the maximum amount of information and, in the time that we have there, how will I worship God? How will I plan to worship God? I think about that from time to time, and I wonder if I give that, adequate, consideration in preparation for the feast. I want to use myself as a good example of a bad example. In the mid-1970s, I was asked with some of the others at the feast in Big Sandy to take over a certain service responsibility that was to be done during the feast. And I was glad to have that opportunity. And the service opportunity took some preparation before the beginning of that service activity. And so what I found myself doing was it was very difficult to go to the services and do the preparation that I needed to do before the services were over and the activity took place. 1 year after the feast was over, I sat back and I thought about the festival experience in Big Sandy, and I realized that I had attended in person one service. One service out of the many, many services that we had. I listened to every one of the services over the loudspeaker system or the intercom system that we had at that time. But I realized I had attended only one service. I thought, this is not the right thing to be doing henceforth. So I made up my mind at that point that I would never do that again if I could help it. And I set as the goal from that time, to present day, that one of my goals in preparation for the feast is to try to attend every service, try to be in personal attendance. Now, by no means do I wish to, you know, to cause anyone to feel badly about their situation. If you're physically not able to attend, or if you have illness, or you have family health situations, or whatever it may be, and that, as has already been mentioned, if you're not able to be there in person, it is truly a blessing to have an opportunity via the web or, you know, by whatever means to participate in the services and to receive the blessing of the services via technology. But there's no substitute for worshiping God at the feast at services in person. A number of years ago, I heard a message for the opening night service at the feast that was one of the best and most influential that I've ever personally heard. And I would like to take the theme from that particular message and share that with you this afternoon, because that's been on my mind in preparation for the feast, you know, where we come into God's presence, where he has established his name. And that's what I'd like to do this afternoon is to consider for each of us and all of us to consider how we will conduct ourselves in preparation for coming into the presence of God at the four fall feasts that are upon us. I'd like to spend a good bit of time in the Old Testament today to look at some different examples of Old Testament figures and what happened to them as they came into God's presence. If you would, let's turn to Exodus 3 and let's read of the account of Moses and how Moses came into God's presence, and let's see what we can learn from that. Exodus 3, and we'll read verses 1 to 6. And this is the account that you all know very well, Moses and the burning bush. Exodus 3, and beginning at verse 1. Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. And he led the flock to the back of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. Did a little bit of reading on the internet to try to figure out where is Midian? Where is Midian? Several of the sites indicated on maps that In today's geography, we would say that's northwestern Saudi Arabia. At least that's what several different sites indicated. I'm not sure if that's precise or not, but if you think of Mount Sinai, or not Mount Sinai, but the Sinai Peninsula as kind of a triangle, you've got the Red Sea on one side, you've got the Gulf of Aqaba on the other side, and this is to the east of that Sinai Peninsula on the east side of the Gulf of Aqaba, northwest Saudi Arabia. That's where a number of sites indicated that they believe that when Midian is referred to, that's what it's talking about, very desert area. So this is where Moses was with that flock. Verse 2, and the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire from the midst of a bush. And so he looked and beheld the bush was burning with fire, but the bush was not consumed. You know, Moses had been out there in that desert for a long time. And I think Moses was probably pretty aware with his experience in tending the flocks of what was customary, what was ordinary, and what wasn't. You know, he wasn't a weekend hunter, so to speak. You know, he spent at this time in his life a great deal of time in the outdoors. So this was a sight that caught his attention based on the phenomenon that he's seeing. You know, some of us visualize the bush of maybe something that's 2 feet high, you know. Could have been something that was a bush like sagebrush or something like that. I don't think there's any way to derive that from the context of how big of a bush and how big of a fire was this. Regardless of the size, it was definitely something that caught Moses' attention, continuing in verse 3. Then Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush does not burn. Verse 4, so when the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called to him from the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, and Moses answers, says, here I am. Verse 5, then he said, do not draw near this place. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground. And that's the point of Moses' first contact with God. He comes into God's presence, and what happens? God says, take your shoes off because where you're standing is holy ground. And we know and we understand that the only way that something is made holy is by God's involvement with it or God's presence. We don't create holy time. God creates holy time. You know, there's the example of the creation in Genesis. God made the Sabbath holy. Exodus 20 verse 4 says to us, keep the Sabbath holy. We don't make the Sabbath holy. God does that. And in this same instance here, God or Moses comes into close proximity with God and God tells him, you know, get your shoes off. You know, where you're standing is holy, you know, with the unspoken statement of it's holy because I am holy. And I make it holy by my presence, you know, here in this place. We definitely got Moses' attention with that. So what was Moses' response? You know, he took his shoes off. He took his sandals off or whatever footwear that he was wearing. So he came into God's presence and demonstrated humility and obedience in that, you know, he was told, you know, you're coming into a place that is holy. Take your shoes off. And so he did. Finishing in verse 6. Moreover, he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. I think that the point, or one of the aspects of this that's really interesting to me, is God is very particular about how he wants us and someone to come into his presence. Why did he do that to Moses? You know, I can't adequately answer that other than just reading the verses and seeing that, you know, the Creator, you know, the one who became Jesus Christ, when he interacted with Moses, he told Moses to take his shoes off. Moses did so. And Moses was very definitely in a humble position, you know, and in a fearful position because of the power that was demonstrated at that place at that time. Even to this day, you know, in the Orient, it is a custom and it is a sign of respect that if you enter someone's home or you enter certain meeting halls, you will take your shoes off. You will not enter into someone's home and tramp around with your shoes. That is a sign of respect for the household and for the owners of the house. You will remove your footwear. That's a custom in the Far East even to this day. Second example I'd like to take a look at is with Joshua. Let's turn over to Joshua chapter 5 and read three verses out of the account where Joshua comes into the presence of God. Joshua chapter 5, and we'll read verses 12 to 15. Joshua chapter 5, let's read verses 12 to 15. And at this place, this is the point where the Exodus essentially has taken place. You know, the Israelites have wandered, they've left Egypt, they've wandered for the amount of time that they were out there in the desert at God's direction. And now they are ready to enter the promised land. And they're on the scene there, you know, at Jericho. And at this point, then it says in verse 12, then the manna ceased on the day after they had eaten the produce of the land, and the children of Israel no longer had manna, but they ate the food of the land of Canaan that year. So here they are, they're finished in terms of their traveling. Now they're ready to enter the promised land. Verse 13. And it came to pass when Joshua was by Jericho that he lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, a man stood opposite him with a sword drawn in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said to him, are you for us or for our adversaries? Great question. Can you imagine that if you walked out into the parking lot across the street and there's someone standing by your car with a drawn sword? It would take a lot of courage to walk up and say, are you for us or are you for our adversaries? I don't know that there's any way to derive this from the context, but part of this, I believe that the way that it can be written is Joshua went to this person and that he was also armed and that there may have been a confrontation if the individual had said, no, I'm with the adversaries. But the individual that he approached had a drawn sword in his hand, so he knew that this individual had a weapon and was demonstrating that he had a weapon. Again, I can't tell from the context, and I don't know anyone that can explain one way or the other whether that was what kind of an encounter that was, whether Joshua really truly had his own sword, whether he had his sword out or not, or whether he just walked up to an individual that had a weapon in his hand and asked that question. Let's continue in 14. So he said, no, But as commander of the army of the Eternal, or of the Lord, I have come, or I have now come. And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshipped and said to him, what does my Lord say to his servant? So Joshua recognized right there that this individual was God, and that he had come into the presence of God. He drops on his, you know, his hands and knees and, you know, bows his face to the ground and worships this individual who was God. Verse 15. Then the commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, take your sandals off your foot, for the place where you stand is holy. And Joshua did so. Another example of an individual coming into the presence of God. What happens? He's told, take your shoes off. You're coming into the presence of a holy one. And this holy one makes this surrounding area, this immediate surrounding area, holy. And Joshua did so. Joshua was down in whatever position, prostrate or on his hands and knees or whatever, in a position of subservience, of obeisance, you know, of submission to this divine being who had just revealed himself to Joshua. I have a couple of swords that I'd like to talk with you about for just a minute and to show you some things about the attitude of a sword and what that might communicate. These two swords were my father-in-law's, and he was in the United States military service in the medical corps during the Second World War, and he brought both of these swords back to the United States from him, or with him, upon the completion of his service. This first sword that you'll see is pretty much a straight line. So when I draw the sword out of its scabbard, you see a very narrow blade. You know, this type of sword here with this type of hilt is not used for slashing. It's used more for a stabbing type, and it's a ceremonial sword. You know, this pattern goes back, probably 300 years, and it is almost identical to the pattern of the sword that's used in the United States Military Academy at present for the ceremonies that take place there. The second sword is a little bit more in the shape of the saber. And you see that the blade has a curvature to it. It's about 31 inches long, something like that. And it can be used either to slash in one manner or another, or to stab. You know, it has a sharp point, double-edged point, and then the blade runs the length. So this is a little different type sword. This pattern goes back probably to, some say, the middle 1850s, and it's based on a pattern there that goes back into the mid-1200s. So this sword has a little bit different look to it, and it's also used for ceremonial purposes, but it has, as a weapon, many more uses than the other. Now, what I would like to do is step away from the microphone and to show a couple of different positions or attitudes. And so you think about Joshua approaching an individual with a sword in his hand. And at first, I'm just going to show a friendly posture. So there's no threat from me in that. I have the sword in my left hand. You know, I'm in that sense, I'm waving to you. But the text here in Joshua, you know, 12 to 15 says that this individual, God had a drawn sword in his hand. And the point of this part of the presentation, and no pun intended, is to observe the point. Now, I personally am not comfortable coming into the presence of someone with a weapon unless I know that person fairly well. And so here's an unknown figure that Joshua sees and approaches, and this individual, Jesus Christ in the Old Testament, has a drawn sword in his hand. And if you will, notice the way you will feel when I do two different demonstrations of attitude as I hold the sword. If I'm in if I'm in a ready position with the point down, I'm not demonstrating the same degree of threat that I am if the point's up. And if I have that, the point of that saber or that sword up, that comes across to me as a lot more of a ready threat or an apparent threat than if I'm in a low ready position with the point, you know, in a lower position there. Maybe just a fine little point, somebody with a drawn sword in their hand, unless I know them and know what they're thinking, I take that as a very serious threat. But this is what Joshua encountered. This individual, you know, the God of the Old Testament revealed himself, and at some kind of a distance that we were not told, Joshua sees this person, sees that drawn sword in his hand, approaches him and said, "Are you for us or against us?" And then the God of the Old Testament reveals himself, you know, as to who he is. Joshua hits the ground, and what is he told? "Take off your shoes, because where you're standing is holy ground." Coming into the presence of God, and you're on holy ground. Get your shoes off. That point on the opening night of the feast quite a number of years ago resonated with me throughout that feast. Every service that I went to, I thought about that point. I'm coming into the presence of God. You know, take your shoes. I did not necessarily physically, but in my mind, in my approach, take your shoes off of your feet because you're standing on holy ground. God has placed his name here. You know, his presence is here. Take your shoes off. Approach this as you are coming into the presence of God. We're going to worship God at the feast. It's not a vacation. Sometimes I think it's easy to confuse the two, that the approach that we may take, even though God commands us to rejoice, and we have tremendous opportunities with faithfully keeping the second tithe and having the resources to spend in, you know, 8 days and some travel, you know, money that we have saved for a year. It's a great blessing. It's a great blessing. So we have, you know, many opportunities to do things that we normally can't do. But through that all, you know, we are coming into the presence of God. And ideologically, and I think our mindset needs to be, and hopefully will be, that take off your shoes, for the ground on which you're standing is holy. Let's turn forward to the one section of scripture that I'd like to read in the third point here, and that is Stephen's account in Acts 7 of Moses coming into the presence of God. Stephen adds a little bit that is not in the Old Testament, and I find that particularly interesting. This third section is actually going to be, you know, kind of a repeat a little bit of what we read in Exodus 3, but I'd like to pick up a few verses or pick out a few verses out of Acts 7 that Stephen gives us some information that I don't believe is available anywhere else. You know, Stephen is defending himself from false accusations, and he is defending himself to the council at that time. And we've got to remember that Saul, later the Apostle Paul, was probably, you know, a witness to this. It's certainly recorded that, you know, those that stoned Stephen, you know, left their, you know, some of their garments with the young Saul. So he was, you know, he knew what was going on, or at least I believe he was very much involved in this and knew what was taking place. Just going to pick up in the section. The whole section is from Acts 7, verse 20, about Moses down to 33. We're not going to read all of that. It talks about, you know, Moses' birth and his education in Egypt, how he was trained in the knowledge and, you know, the educational system, you know, of the Egyptians at that time. And at some point he becomes interested and he knew his roots well enough. He knew where he'd come from, and he wanted to go back and find out how the Israelites were doing. Goes down, sees an Egyptian abusing an Israelite, intervenes and kills the Egyptian. You know, and you think, wow, you know, he was a very powerful figure, but that was quite an intervention. Something happens the next day. There are two Israelites that are arguing. The one that, and Moses, when he intervenes to try to, you know, to cause a peaceful outcome to take place here, the one that's at fault says, why are you doing this? You're going to kill me like you did that Egyptian yesterday? So then all of a sudden Moses realizes that, you know, the word's out. You know, this isn't something that is going to remain, you know, in limited circulation. This is this his deed of this, the killing of the Egyptian, is a lot more widely known than what he had hoped. And the section that I find interesting there is in 23. Now when he's 40 years old, you know, he goes to visit his brethren. When he goes out there to Midian, he's out there for 40 years. I want to see, my eye doesn't find on that, fall on that verse. It's verse 30, down to verse 30. And when 40 years had passed, he's out there in the desert with those sheep or flocks or goats or whatever that was. He's out there for 40 years. You know, by this time, you know, we're looking at an individual that's 80 years old or a little bit older. But he's been out there in the land of Midian with that livestock for 40 years. And that's, that Stephen reveals that to us. I don't believe that's stated in the Old Testament. And then we have the same account. When Moses, you know, then he sees this bush burning. When he marveled at the sight, and as he drew near, the voice of the Lord said to him, continuing in verse 32, saying, I am the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses trembled and dared not look. 33. Then the Lord said to him, take your sandals off your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground. You know, that's recorded, you know, by you know, the writer of the book of Acts, you know, with the testimony that Stephen gave before he was later, you know, murdered by the people that stoned him to death. Let's look at another example of a couple of individuals who came into God's presence with a very different outcome. Very different outcome. Let's turn back to Leviticus 10. Leviticus 10. And we're going to begin in a section here that this is actually the conclusion of the consecration of the priests. And it was 7 or 8 days. I'm not sure, you know, well, which it was that this consecration was to take place. There were very specific instructions given to Aaron and his sons as to what they were to do and the offerings that were to be done and, you know, all of the things that were to take place there. And then this follows right on the heels of that in Leviticus 10, beginning in verse 1. Then Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, each took his censer and put fire in it and put incense on it, and offered profane fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them. For your reference, I believe it's Exodus 30, verse 9, that had some very specific instructions from God about don't be offering, you know, what's called strange fire, which is also translated as unholy or profane. So they did something, for whatever reason, that God had explicitly told them not to do. What happens? Verse 2, so fire went out from the Lord and devoured them, and they died before the Lord. This is right after God had just done almost the same thing with the sacrifices, showing at the end of that period of consecration of the priest, that he was very much engaged in what was going on, because one of the sacrifices, the fire of the Lord comes out, consumes that sacrifice. I can't imagine that was the kitchen match size flame, because people saw that and they were impressed by that. So that was some event to behold when the fire came out from God and consumed, you know, the sacrifice that they had just, you know, put on the altar. Right on the heels of that, two men make a mistake. They pay for it with their lives. The fire comes out from God and kills them on the spot. You know, and as we continue in verse 3, and then you've got the aftermath of this. You know, we've got two deceased priests on the ground right at the conclusion of this consecration ceremony that's been going on for 7 days. Moses said to Aaron, this is what the Lord spoke, saying, by those who come near me, I must be regarded as holy. If we are going to come into God's presence, you know, it's recorded for us here that we must regard God as holy. And continuing in the verse, and before all the people, I must be glorified. The words of God to Moses. that by those who come near me, I must be regarded as holy, and before all people, I must be glorified. So Aaron held his peace, because I'm sure Aaron, he just lost two of his four sons that we have record of, you know, in a very startling and a very dramatic, you know, fashion and event that has just taken place. And so I'm sure everybody was wondering, what happened? Why was that? You know, what's going to happen next? Let's drop down to verse 7. You shall not, and these are the instructions to Aaron from Moses. You shall not go out from the door of the tabernacle of meeting, lest you die. For the anointing oil of the Lord is upon you. That was put on them. They were anointed as part during that 7 days of consecration, and that was a very special ceremony that took place. And they did according to the word of Moses. Verse 9. And here's what I think, because of the context, I think this explains or has the potential to explain a little bit about what happened in verse 1. Why did these two men do that? Why did they make this mistake? I find it very interesting that verse 9 is inset here. Do not drink wine or intoxicating drink, you nor your sons with you, when you go into the tabernacle of meeting, lest you die. Why is that? You might be in a state of mind or a state physically where you're not adequately coming into the presence of God. Maybe you're partially inebriated. You know, is that the way that these two individuals came into God's presence? Don't know. Can't derive that from the text, but I think it's very curious that verse 9 is right in the middle of this account. Some instructions there that are very specific about don't be drinking in your priestly responsibilities when you come into the presence of God. It's important to God how people come into his presence. And we've seen a couple of positive examples with Moses and with Joshua. We've seen a couple of examples here, or this example with Nadab and Abihu, where that they made a mistake, and God took very great exception to that and killed them on the spot because they did not come into his presence in a manner that was befitting. Continuing in verse 10, that you may distinguish between holy and unholy, between clean and unclean. And that's, again, that's connected with that verse about the use of alcohol. Verse 11, that you may teach the children of Israel all the statutes which the Lord had spoken to them by the hand of Moses. Don't want to turn there, but I'd like to read to you a verse from Ezekiel. This is a condemnation from God in the book of Ezekiel, chapter 22 and verse 26, reading out of the King James Version. Her priests have violated my laws, have profaned mine holy things. They have put no difference between the holy and profane. I believe that is what happened with Nadab and Abihu. They put no difference between, you know, something that was a holy service, holy part of the service, and something that was meaningless, something that was profane in that sense. It was strange. And they were specifically commanded to not do that. Continuing in Ezekiel 22:26, neither have they showed difference between the clean and or the unclean and clean, and have hid their eyes from my Sabbath, and I am profaned among them. A condemnation of, you know, the priests by Ezekiel, by God through the prophet Ezekiel. I'd like to focus now on this next area in some of the specificity and some of the detail that God gave in the form of instructions to Aaron in how Aaron was to come into the presence of God. And I'm amazed at just how detailed those instructions or these instructions are. We think, now, why would God do that? You know, I don't have an adequate explanation for why he wants it done that way, but he does want it done that way. He did want it done that way, and he gave commands that Aaron and the priest would perform these instructions. We usually read this section of scriptures on the Day of Atonement, but let's go over to Leviticus 16 and just pick out some of the verses there about some of the specific instruction that God gave to Aaron and the priests about how they were to come in to his presence, how they were to conduct themselves in the presence of God. 16:1 of Leviticus. And now the Lord spoke to Moses after the death of the two sons of Aaron, when they offered profane fire before the Lord and died. Verse 2, and the Lord said to Moses, tell Aaron your brother not to come in at just any time into the holy place, inside the veil, before the mercy seat, which is on the ark, lest he die. And I will appear in the cloud above the mercy seat. You know, one of the ways that reads to me is that the way that this is stated, perhaps Aaron had a different type of access prior to this. But it's stated to Moses, tell your brother that he's not to be just coming and going anytime he wants to at this point and from this point forward. You know, here is how Aaron is to come into the presence of God one time in this particular manner. Verse 3, and again continuing with the instructions from God to Moses that Moses was going to pass on to Aaron. Thus Aaron shall come into the holy place with the blood of a young bull as a sin offering and of a ram as the burnt offering. Here's what he's supposed to do. Verse 4, he shall put the holy linen tunic and the linen trousers on his body. You know, he shall be girded with a linen sash, and with a linen turban shall he be attired. These are holy garments, therefore he shall wash his body in water and put them on. Here's what you're to wear, very specifically delineated as to what he was to wear, and these garments were created for this purpose, were made for this purpose, and don't put those things on until you've taken a bath. You know, God is not... He is not, you know, wanting someone to come into his presence that had not bathed and then put on these special garments. And so these were the instructions that were given, very detailed, very specific instructions about how Aaron was to come into the presence of God. Let's drop down to verse 23 of 16. It's a little bit more about that kind of specificity. Then Aaron shall come into the tabernacle of meeting, shall take off the linen garments which he put on when he went into the holy place, and he shall leave them there. 24, and he shall wash his body with water in a holy place, put on his garments, come out, offer the burnt offering and the burnt offering of the people, and make atonement for himself and for the people. Very detailed instructions. 28, to conclude. Then he who, you know, and this is what's happened, what was to happen with, you know, with some of the remains of the proceedings of the offering. And he who burns them, which was going to take place outside the camp, he who burns them shall wash his clothes, bathe his body in water, and then afterward he's permitted to come back into the camp. And again, lots of detail. But when God gives those kinds of instructions, that's obviously, you know, very significant, very important to him. And he expected the priesthood at that time to follow those instructions to the letter. You know, they were supposed to perform those functions. They were supposed to do what they were told. What does this have to do with us? You know, we've got a number of Old Testament examples, and what does this have to do with us in 2012, 17 days from the Feast of Trumpets, 1 month from, you know, the beginning of the Feast of Tabernacles? You know, one of the things is that, you know, these are the feasts of the Lord. Leviticus 23:4, I'd like to read to you. Leviticus 23 and verse 4, and the whole chapter goes through in detail the feasts and each of the feasts in their order and what those feasts mean. Just want to focus on 4. These are the feasts of the Lord, holy convocations, which you shall proclaim at their appointed times. Those were the instructions to the people of that day. They're instructions to us in our day. And to conclude, let's read 3 verses in Deuteronomy 16. And this section of scripture we very frequently refer to in On the holy days, at the time when an offering is taken up, and the instructions for that are actually a little bit after this section that I want to read. I want to read verses 13 through 15. Deuteronomy 16, 13 to 15. You shall observe the Feast of Tabernacles 7 days, when you've gathered from your threshing floor and from your winepress. 14. And you shall rejoice in your feast. We're told to rejoice. You, your son, your daughter, your male servant, your female servant, the Levites or the priesthood in that case, the stranger or the person that is not a native to your culture, the fatherless and the widow, those that are have some special needs who are within your gates, those who you have control over, those who are in your sphere of influence, they're to keep the feast too, and then they're listed. Family members, those that were the servants, and then those that had, some special needs. Verse 15, 7 days you shall keep a sacred feast to the Lord your God in the place which the Lord chooses. We're told it's a holy convocation. We're told that we're to keep the feast in a place where he chooses. Because the Lord your God will bless you in all your produce and in all the work of your hands so that you surely rejoice. We're fixing to come into the presence of God here in the four fall feasts that are upon us. Hopefully we can approach these feasts with the mindset that take off our shoes for the place where we stand is holy ground. And hopefully this thought can resonate, with us through the observance of these four fall feasts, and especially the Feast of Tabernacles and the last great day, as we are commanded to rejoice in a place where God has placed his name, and he expects us, when we come into his presence, to treat him as holy, because he is holy, and he gives us those specific commands. Take off your shoes, for the place where you stand is holy ground.